Welcome back to another episode of Autodesk's Digital Builder Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Thomas. We are in downtown San Francisco at Autodesk's One Market office right now. I am joined by John Marks, the Chief Technology Officer from Swinnerton. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing great today, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here on Digital Builder. It's also a pleasure to be back here at One Market. This was one of my first jobs in the construction industry as a young project engineer.
Really? Well, it's fun to see that come back full circle, and I appreciate your work on this building. It's such a cool space. It's been interesting to see how Autodesk's use of, you know, the parts that we have has evolved over time. So happy to be here. And the last time that we met, we had a really good conversation that tied to topics with technology and construction, sustainability, delivery methods. We could have recorded that discussion and used it as a podcast on its own merit. But I wanted to come back to the core theme that you kept mentioning, and that's tied to people. And so with that in mind, could you share your thoughts about how leaders can ensure that are really truly putting their people first, especially when you're thinking about implementing technology or process changes that might impact their teams?
Well, I'm a big fan of the human-centered design processes, human-centric design. I'll put in a plug here for the LUMA Institute. It's where I got my training around human-centered design. And it's when you put people first with your technology, and more than your technology, but that you really can't go wrong in your implementation. You can make mistakes along the way, but you will ultimately hit your goals. I'd also say it's really important to listen well. And that's listen, observe, have a deep sense of empathy for your customers that you're trying to serve with technology, whether it's internal or external. And ultimately, communicate. You may feel like you're over-communicating, but you can never do it enough. You have to have an open door policy, and you have to leave those lines of communications constantly open.
It's such an important nuance, too, and it's easy to get excited about new technology, and there's so many things coming out in the construction industry specifically. I remember I was at a conference a number of years ago, and I was talking about exactly what you just shared as far as making sure people have a voice in that process. And somebody responded to what I had said in that moment and was like, it's not a democratic process. And we kind of went back and forth. And the way I tried to clarify that to him is, it's not necessarily giving every single person a vote on the final technology thing, but exactly what you said, it's the conversation, because you're learning what they're dealing with. They're learning why you're implementing things. And everybody feels a whole lot better about that process, both in meeting their needs and then also at the end of the day, making them feel that they understand why, instead of surprise, here's a new thing that changes how you do your job. There's a lot of nuance involved in it. And with all of that in mind, everybody touches these new workflows. Everybody touches new technology in their career. How do you ensure that everybody has those opportunities to learn about that new technology or learn about these new processes so they don't feel so surprised or caught off guard when you do make changes or bring in new technology?
It's a great question and a really big challenge, particularly for our industry. Construction teams, they'll be over their heads for 18 to 36 months, and they don't have time or bandwidth to absorb change during that period of time. So you really have these limited opportunities that you can effectively deliver change to project teams. And that's typically when they're either in downtimes in their construction schedule or they're between jobs. Well, if you scale that across an organization, you can't teach an entire organization a thing at one time. You actually have to run that change management process over the course of 18 to 36 months to ensure that your entire employee base can absorb change. So it's a particularly tough job for the construction industry to deliver that change. The other thing I would say is that often it is the project teams out in the field that are teaching us about technology and getting out into the field on a regular basis, walking the job sites, having conversations with superintendents and foremen and project engineers and project managers is the most effective way to learn about really what's next in the marketplace, what's coming, where the opportunities and challenges lie. So that level of engagement, which is not easy to get people out of their chairs and out into the job sites, but it's important to be intentional about that.
it all makes sense. And I remember so well. So, of course, I spent so many years doing proposal management and working in some change management stuff at a number of GCs. And if I think about your example in the context of writing technical sections for new proposals, of course, we're working with the proposed project team to make sure the technical section aligns with their expectations and everything. In trying to even just balance, hey, can you give me 2 pages on how you're going to build this parking structure or this campus for a university on top of their day-to-day, it is really difficult. And so communicating not just, I need you to do something for me, but I'm here to implement some level of change at your organization. There's a human element and a lot of people skills that go into that to do that well. And having empathy of where's your bandwidth? How can we meet you in the middle? And there's so many ways we can change how we train and bring everybody together. I don't think it's, you know, everybody's in a trailer for 8 hours with an instructor up in front saying, here's all the processes and everything. You've got to meet people where they're at. And so, especially in the last few years, I feel like that's pivoting. It's changing now. And conversations like these ones, I think, have an impact on those nuances too. So it's a bunch of fun.
Yeah, I would say that probably the most effective way that I've seen in recent years of delivering changes is in bite sizes, is in that 3-minute video or that 1-page how to. Keep it small, keep it short, deliver it so people can consume it in 5 minutes or less.
Yeah. And it's easier to go back to that too, because you go, I only need to worry about this thing, or I can't remember how this one small aspect goes because I only do it once every 3 months. And not to have to parse through an 8-hour training video, you can pop in. And if your training stuff is set up well, you snag that snippet, you go, this is how I use this aspect of this tech or this tool or software, and then away you go. So thinking about upskilling workers, I know is top of mind for most people, especially within the realm of technology and construction. How can companies really empower their people to go even further, learning about advanced technology that might be outside of the scope of what the company is doing? So if there's something new, how do you facilitate that curiosity and give them the realm to try new stuff, even if it's not deployed across your company?
Usually the curiosity is already there, and it's really about giving people room to be curious and permission to be curious. So that involves managers being intentional about providing their employees the time to do it, whether that is one Friday a month that an employee gets to choose how they work and what they learn, or having group knowledge sessions to bring a team together for the sole purpose of learning something new. But then also to send the right signals. If managers themselves are not demonstrating their own curiosity and sharing what they're learning and sending the signal that it's okay to spend your time learning something new, chasing a passion, then people won't do it. I mean, ultimately, employees will follow the lead of their managers. So it's important to do that. I think it's also important that organizations pivot from training to skills development. Because training is this event that happens. Skills development happens every day. It happens in your experiences. It happens in those bite-sized knowledge transfers I mentioned earlier. It happens with your experience, with your mentors, with your coaches. But organizations that recognize all of that counts, all of that is valuable and leading towards the development of their employees will have a much easier path to upskilling their workforce.
And that comes right back to what you started talking about today in communication, because you're communicating that it's okay to be curious and interested in this, or you're communicating that if you want to try these things, we're going to create some space for you to do that. I don't know if organizations have always been that way. I feel like we're starting to implement more of those changes. The way we work is different. And of course, in construction, we're building stuff. So people still need to be on site. People are going to be going there. But finding ways to offer more flexibility, I think, empowers people to make and look for those opportunities. And that empowers your organization, too. There's a lot of retention there. There's just enthusiasm about the organization that they work for versus these are the 8 hours or 10 hours you have to be on site, and this is what you're allowed to do. And if you step outside of that, you put yourself at risk. And nobody wants that.
Yeah. And our industry struggles with flexibility, shall we say, for good reason. It's a dangerous industry we're in, and it's important to follow certain methodologies in order for everyone to stay safe. And that conservative behavior is embedded for good reason in the culture of construction. So to find that flexibility in your culture is a challenge for some companies. But I, like you, I observe that a lot of companies are changing.
Yeah, we've kind of been forced into it in some ways in the last few years. And I'll spare everybody the pandemic talk, but we've been forced to reevaluate how we approach work. And of course, my example, like I work for a technology that supports the construction industry. So where I work and how I work is going to be a lot more flexible than somebody that's out building. But I think there's a lot to learn from that, because you can still be productive, you can still be focused, and you can bring value to the organization and not lean back into the butts and seats is productivity on the project side. So finding that middle ground and talking to your employees, I think, has a huge value. And like the morale within, you know, Autodesk, if I look at our own organization, has gone up tremendously from what I've been told and what we've been understanding in employee retention and surveys and everything, because it's a conversation about flexibility to understand what works instead of something that's a bit more prescriptive. And like you said, the safety element in construction is so paramount that we have to be mindful of how we have those conversations, but there's still ones that are worth having at the beginning and the end of the day.
Absolutely. And I believe that every position is unique in how that person in that position can be most effective and make the biggest contribution to their organization. And I think it's important for leaders to really focus on that to align a work policy, work environment to that position, as opposed to making some broad cultural statement that we must be together. And I would also say to leaders out there that if your culture breaks because people have some more flexible work, you probably need to work on your culture, because, yeah, putting butts in seats is not necessarily the strongest cultural element.
Yeah, and I've lived that. I remember having evening calls because I was working on big international projects and still being expected to be at my desk 40 hours a week, even though 2 days a week I was on the phone, because this was 8-10 years ago where Zoom wasn't a thing yet. So it was all the horrible conference line with the music that played forever, the 30-second clip. And we just didn't have the flexibility to take those 3 or 4 hour calls and offset how we spent our time in the office. And that was very frustrating. And I know a lot of people were upset about it. It's a understandable reason to listen to people when they have those frustrations and create a space where it's okay to have those conversations instead of responding with punishment or something else a bit inappropriate. But that kind of leads into my next question. And everybody talks about the labor challenges in construction. Sometimes I think people tire of it, but it's an ongoing issue, and it's going to be even more so as more retire and leave the industry or look for other opportunities if they do feel burned out. And so I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on how we can be more effective in addressing the labor shortage in construction. Like, what are some of the things that we can do to either enact change that either retains talent at companies or alternatively brings new people into the industry that haven't worked in it before?
We talked about the flexibility, and I think it is important for leaders to embrace that flexibility to find the best people for your organization, because they can be anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world, and to walk away from the value that someone can bring to your company because you can't put them in your office can be a mistake for leaders out there.
And that's a conversation people were not having 5 years ago for the most part. So it's encouraging to hear you say that.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot has opened people's eyes, and people had to get really creative over the past few years. And that just brought a lot of productivity tools and gave people the work environments where they could be their best professional selves. The other thing I've seen in our industry is community engagement is really important to bring new people into the industry and to create diversity inside of an organization. And I'll, just as an aside, I believe the most effective organizations are those organizations that make diversity a priority in their talent. Different perspectives sitting around a table will lead to the best decisions. So it is critical for companies to have that community engagement and make sure that their organizations reflect the communities they work in. But a lot of construction industries companies put community engagement with their business development team, and to ensure that they are able to meet the MBE, WBE requirements for projects. I believe those programs should be in their ESG programs, that those should not be business development activities, but should be pure community engagement. People know when you are honestly approaching them to have a conversation, to share your knowledge and experiences and invite them into your industry. If you're doing it just to chase work, people see through that and it can have a negative effect on your diversity goals. So I think it's important to be honest when you approach the community, to do it with an open heart and good intentions and not just chasing more business.
I love how you frame that, because I work for an organization that was one of a federal contractor that was mostly doing like small disadvantaged businesses. And a lot of the stuff, the work they were getting was to fill those requirements that you're just alluding to right there. And later, when working for larger organizations that didn't fit that mold, trying to fill those gaps just because of the contractual requirements was really difficult. And I remember especially working in less diverse parts of the country where we were bidding on projects in the Midwest, where there might not be as many of these types of organizations. It was really difficult. And at the time, I was very junior in my career. And so just listening passively to those conversations. But what you're saying right now really resonates with me if I look retrospectively at that, because you're building those relationships for the sake of building those relationships. And it's going to be easier to bring people into the fold because you're authentically trying to do that. Not, again, simply because, well, the federal government says I have to allocate 10% of my project staffing or material sourcing or whatever to this type of business. And that's a very different conversation to have with somebody. And of course, those businesses, some of them exist because they know they can take advantage of that. And that's okay. Like, please continue doing that. We want people to have those opportunities. But I think the framing that you're making right now, that has a really big impact. I like that. I hadn't thought about it in that fashion before.
I mean, this is a incredible industry to be part of. I've been proud to be in this industry for 30 years. I can't imagine myself working anything else or anywhere else. And so for me to share that experience with others, honestly, is a mentoring relationship, which can help someone develop their own business, their own career, which can then return rewards to your own personal satisfaction, but also your company and your career as well. But that all started with, again, that passion for sharing your experience, not a need to check a box on a federal form, right? That's the difference. And you'll reap much bigger rewards that way.
And I love the fact that I get to have conversations like this all the time, because people in construction are passionate about this industry. It's such an important one. It's so neat. Like, look at the space we're sitting in right now. Like, this is a really cool environment to be, you know, hanging out in and having this conversation. But construction touches everybody. And not everyone thinks about it in that way. You know, but if you think about it, we have to have our houses, we have to have our spaces, we have places to work, hospitals, everything else. And just having chances to share that enthusiasm with others is a ton of fun, which kind of tails into the next question I had for you. Is there anything else that comes to mind when you think about making yourself as an attractive employer to potential staffing? Like, is there anything else that is really key to implement to look good while we're trying to chase these talented labor when the competition is admittedly very fierce?
I would say one of the most important things we can do, which we don't do a very good job of it, and I think the culture of our industry is such, is we don't toot our own horn very well. But to share with people really the why it's so much fun to be in this industry. I mean, there's a sense of camaraderie on job sites. The team, there's nothing more rewarding than working with a high-performing team. And you get those opportunities in construction all the time because of the construction environment, with the everyday working to achieve a goal. It's incredibly rewarding to walk the streets of your town or a city you've worked in and to be able to point at a building and say, I built that.
I love that.
It is. And we don't share that experience with people. But when I do work with young people in the industry today, and particularly craft workers, I mean, they have a ton of fun in their jobs and they work hard. They play hard afterwards. They form lifelong friendships in the trenches of construction. It's what I did when I was a union laborer. I think if we can share those stories, we wouldn't have the labor shortages that we're talking about today, because you can build a solid middle class lifestyle and have a very rewarding career in this industry. And you just have to reach out and grab that bottom rung, and that ladder will take you all the way as far as you want to go.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I remember the first time I got to walk a project site after being part of the proposal process, where we'd won, we'd seen the plans, and you know, we write out our technical section and everything's there. And then 6 months later, 12 months later, getting a chance to do a site walk and walking around that facility that was just fiction at that point. We're all talking about it. We have the plans, we're looking at it. And it was such a cool experience. And I think that's just one extra step further for those that are on site doing the building. Like, I'll be honest, like I'm a tourist when I'm on a project site. I would never pretend like I have the skill set of a project manager or something else, but the core foundation of what's being done just has always really resonated with me. It's fun, and I'm hopeful that we can continue chipping away at that perception problem that we do have in the industry and bring more people in and understanding the conversation that we're having right now. Like, there's neat stuff, there's cool technology, it's fun, and there's a lot of room to grow.
I think it's okay to brag about our industry. I try to do it more often.
Agreed. And it's one of the reasons why I'm thankful that we get to, you know, do all of this stuff. So I want to pivot our conversation. And I think people are still a core part of everything else I'd like to ask you about today. But the other part of what we talked about when we first met was tied to sustainability and some materials advancements and such. And so just to kind of set a baseline today, could you share some more of the accessible ways that contractors and owners can really start thinking about sustainability in their projects? I feel like there's low-hanging fruit that not everybody might be thinking about just to get started in a more meaningful way down that path.
First, I think construction companies, general contractors and specifically, but also architectural firms, really should not underestimate the impact that they can have in sustainability. I've talked to a lot of leaders who believe that their ability to influence the sustainability of our industry is severely limited. But I don't think that's really the case. I think by having conversations with our clients, with our subcontractors, with our design partners, engineers, just having those conversations can have an outsized influence. General contractors and architects, they sit at the nexus of the industry, and they can have an outsized influence on the decisions that everyone else in that industry can make. So I think that lowest hanging fruit is to not be afraid to talk about it, not be afraid to ask questions, not be afraid to offer options and opportunities to our clients. Because, and I would say the other low-hanging fruit is in the design phase. That is where sustainability starts, particularly when you're able to talk to owners who are going to be holding on to their assets for the long term, for multiple decades. And they're concerned not just about the cost of building, which is a small percentage as compared to the total cost of operation of that facility. And sustainable decisions can actually have a positive impact on those costs by lowering those costs over the course of the building lifecycle. So that's really where I think that low-hanging fruit is. For every company, culture is another place that you can, it's an relatively easy lever to pull, and that you just sending the right signals, doing small things like eliminating single-use plastics from the construction project. Those may have a limited impact in the big, big picture, but they send the right signals. They shift the culture. And then all the individuals in your organization start making decisions that lean towards sustainability. That has a real impact. So I would say, yeah, send those cultural signals, make sustainability a part of your value system of your organization, and then just watch the magic happen.
I love that nuance because, as you said, in the grand scope of something, that the smaller, like not using reusable plastic or something, isn't tremendous as the carbon footprint of a building, for example. But you start making people understand who might not have had those conversations, like why we're doing this and that it does have value. And I love that is it trickles into how we build and how we start having those discussions. And I'm hearing more and more contractors who are having deeper and more meaningful conversations with their owners and their customers and clients too, because as we build those relationships and have those conversations, and I think there's a bit of a reset in how we approach our building methodology that's happening right now too, you start to learn from one another. The contractors have so much knowledge that they can really ask, like, tell me what your goals and your expectations are. And you get to step back and go, well, what about this? Have you heard about this thing here? Or this might save you time in the schedule, or this might make your facility have a bit more leaning towards green or LEED facility rating or something that they might not have thought about. And it's not because they're not interested, but they might not have that knowledge. And so you get to educate upward, especially when you're working with somebody who's a serial builder and you, you know, okay, we're going to do 40 projects for you and they're going to be all very similar, but let's set our baseline and expectations at the front. And that down chain conversation, it has a huge impact.
Yeah, it really does.
So where are you starting to see some more exciting innovations or advancements within the realm of materials and supply chain? I know everybody's thinking about that right now. It's been hard to get things. It's hard to be predictable in where we're getting things. Like what's interesting right now that you'd love to share with me?
In the world of materials, what's really going to make a significant difference and move the needle in our industry and for the planet is going to be in steel and concrete. Those are just incredibly carbon intensive. And there are some products coming to market that significantly reduce the carbon impact of those materials. So I would say in the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to really see the needle move in the built environment because of those two materials reducing their carbon footprint. What we have on the market today that I'm excited about is the mass timber systems. And they have a dual benefit is not only are they a lower carbon footprint in their production, but they also sequester carbon so that you are actually sequestering carbon. If you build a building for the long term, you could be sequestering carbon for hundreds of years. And that does help.
And I'm starting to see more and more in the media mass timber being a real thing. And I was hoping you could tell me a little bit more about how you're actually implementing that at Swinerton. Like, give me a little bit more nuance about the projects and how that's kind of shown up on the project sites.
Yeah, it's actually an interesting story because it's impactful to our business, Swinerton, but the industry as a whole in a few different ways. For those not familiar with the mass timber systems, they're really a structural system. There's two basic components. There's glue, lam, beams, and columns, which have been around forever, and you see them often in residential treatments, but they've been in the commercial market for a long time. And then there's CLT, and which is really just incredibly thick plywood. So it's 8 to 16 inch thick pieces of plywood. And columns and beams, obviously, is a structural system. The CLT panels are what would replace concrete floors and also steel frame floors. It's incredibly popular right now. Architects love mass timber. You walk around a mass timber facility, you see all that beautiful exposed wood, the exposed ceilings of the CLT panels, those glue, lam, columns, and beams. You can create shapes with those systems that you can't do with concrete and steel. So it's a designer's dream, the mass timber products. The other thing has to do with productivity. To erect a mass timber structure takes 5 people, right? You've got a crane operator, you've got the picker loading the crane, you've got a couple guys on the building itself that are unloading and assembling the components. Everything is, all the connections are prefabricated. They just slide in together. So there's no custom work in the field. It's really just locking these pieces of systems in place as if they were Lincoln logs. So it creates a lot of productivity gains in the field. So that's obviously great for schedules, great for owners, great for contractors. It also gives Swinerton the opportunity to really own more of the supply chain, that we actually are fabricating our own connectors, that we have our own facility for doing the fabrication of the glulam columns and beams, so that we can actually ensure the quality of the product before it ever gets to the field. We're able to drive increased profitability as a result, lower costs for our clients. Often these structures are price competitive with concrete and steel. So, I mean, it's just it's a very exciting product and creates a lot of opportunity for contractors to be more than just the general contractor, but to be a true builder on site.
It's neat seeing all of this come together. In the prefabrication conversation, I think, is starting to get more and more meaningful in recent years, especially as you alluded to, the scope and the capability of those materials that we're using has started to change now. So letting people understand prefab isn't just a boring gray box that you stand up and you go, we built this cheaply elsewhere and stood it up. You can build these incredibly beautiful structures that a lot of people, I think, might not have full scope and understanding of. So I appreciate you sharing the context there. And it's also been kind of neat to see so many more contractors bringing more self-performed work into the conversation too, because you're not just, okay, we're the executive management team, but we're bringing all the subs. The in-house conversation changes when you do have the people on staff and you build this talent and you build this pool. And then those people also recognize and see, okay, like, we've been invested in as people to build these skill sets. And even though our project has ended here, I can be confident that I'm going to be brought to a new project down the line and not just saying, okay, project's done, you know, head off home. So there's so many layered benefits to adopting some of these methodologies and finding innovative ways to bring and meet some of our material challenges right now. It's a fun moment. And just like you said, get kind of nerdy and looking around and going, gosh, this is cool. We can design all this stuff that you might not have been able to do with concrete, or you can do in a scope and scale that you just simply might have not have been able to do.
You mentioned self-perform work. It's one of the most exciting things about Swinerton right now. The past 5 years is, for most of my career at Swinerton, we had a very small number of craft employees. But today we have as many or more craft employees than we do administrative employees. So we are performing a lot more of our work. That ensures that we can control quality, we can control safety on the job site, we have a lot more control over cost and schedule. It really allows us to, and I'll quote my CEO, Eric Foster here, is to control our own destiny on the project site, that we can deliver what the client expects when they expect it with a lot more surety. And that leads to opportunities for a lot more control of the project delivery mechanisms, that we can now control more of the supply chain, buy more of our materials, ensure the quality of those materials, the timeliness of the delivery, all of this. And a lot of this is enabled today by technology. In the past, particularly when I started with the industry, most general contractors were just risk managers. All, you know, we were just distributing risk across the architect and the engineers and all the subcontractors, and then making sure everyone did their job. And our really best tool was to hit people over the head with their contracts. Say, you said you would do this, you will do this. Not a really effective or collaborative way to deliver high quality, safe, low cost, and timely product, right?
It's hard. You know, I mean, everybody needs to protect themselves to some degree. And if the contract vehicle is structured this way, it's understandable to have that slightly adversarial relationship. Yeah.
But today,
it's changing.
Yeah. Today, technology allows us to manage the complexity of the construction project such that we can take on the risk of doing the work ourselves, of purchasing the material, of even doing our own engineering and construction documents, right? This technology allows us to take on this risk ourselves. And that gives us, again, a lot more opportunity for not only improving our own margins, but improving how we deliver for our clients.
I think there's so much there. And in addition to being a risk management role too, construction companies are becoming technology companies. There are so many different tools and technologies and processes to deploy in the industry that if you don't think about it with that lens, it's going to be challenging to stay competitive. It's going to be challenging to bring the talent in. If somebody, especially a young person who is used to using technology and having all of these interesting things in their personal life, gets to work and either they're handed an iPad and a drone and said, let's go build and do this cool stuff, or you know, they have a roll of blueprints and 2 weeks later they change and they miss that, so they built something and now you got to rip it all out. Like, that's a nightmare, obviously, and a generation of a lot of the waste that comes out of construction. And so embracing these changes in new methodologies, I think it's really created an exciting moment with construction, which does lead into my last question I've got for you within this realm before we jump into a couple of fun ones. But I have the chief technology officer sitting in front of me right now from Swinerton. So I can't help but ask one more tech-focused question. Is there any technology advancements or innovations going on right now that you're particularly excited about or find particularly interesting?
Something I've been excited about, and actually for a few years now, and I'm hoping that it comes to fruition in the marketplace, is automated building operations. And that leads back to my passion for sustainability. There is a ton of waste in the operations of the built environment, and particularly buildings inhabited by humans. There's just a ton of wasted energy, wasted water, wasted space. And I believe that with the advent of machine learning algorithms being applied to holistic building systems, that not only can the built environment be a lot more comfortable for the people living in those environments and working in those environments, but the cost of those of the built environment over its lifespan can be significantly reduced, and its impact on the planet can be significantly reduced as well. So as the one day I hope to walk into a building, and as the sun comes up into the windows, the shades are automatically closing as the ambient temperature outside is raising, that the HVA systems are reducing in real time, that as the compressor in the basement is starting to shake a little bit, that the service company is called to come out and fix it before it breaks, that the building intelligently will start to take care of itself in a way that humans just can't manage that complexity to do well. So that's something I'm very excited about. It's just a personal passion of mine, this dream of the automated building.
Yeah. I'm furiously nodding my head right now because it's something I just find very neat on a personal level. So I was telling somebody earlier today, actually, I have a small smart speaker in every room of my house. A lot of my devices in my home are automated. So I have smart light bulbs. I don't touch a light switch in my house. I announce to my friend Google, hey, I want to do a thing, and lights turn off. I have automated things. And that's just the tip of the iceberg as far as what you were alluding to. And I see that in the future myself. And I'm very excited about it because it's just comfortable, even outside from the sustainability aspect. That is also very important as far as managing the HVAC systems and all of these other aspects that if you're not home, your house is still, for lack of a better descriptor, living and breathing. It's just really neat.
Yeah, it is. And I believe that our buildings can learn from us over time, just as your home is probably learning from you and how to best react to your desires of how to live in that space. I believe buildings can do that for all of us who are operating in there together, and not only do well for the environment and for the bottom line, but do well for us as humans.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, even my Google assistant will ask me, like, you tend to turn on this light at this time. Would you like to turn it on or off or whatever?
It's learning.
It's starting to learn, which in some aspects is a little weird. You're starting to get used to it, but I think we're building the infrastructure to make that all make sense and kind of come together.
Yeah.
And I'm just enjoying being, you know, on the outside of the edge of that, at least within what's feasible for my own home at this time right now. It's fun. So I have one more question for you that I ask everybody, and it's a really interesting recurring one tied to tools and the way you work on different projects. So what is one tool that you would bring to any project you work on, no matter what that project happens to be?
It might sound a little cheesy, but mindfulness is the most important thing to bring to any project or any relationship. It is being present. It is being vulnerable. It's being empathetic. It's really being there and observing your environment, the people around you closely and carefully. That's the most important thing. But I will throw in the bonus, because in the physical world, every project I go to, I carry a carpenter's pencil and a tape measure, because you never know when you have to check the dimension.
Absolutely. Tape measure one comes up pretty regularly. Yeah. I was talking about that with somebody yesterday. I think I have four in my house or something. It's always good to have one handy. But your mindfulness answer, I think it really just wraps back up into some of the ethos that I'm just getting from you as we had this conversation, and comes back to that people conversation. And I'm hopeful that more of our leaders have that mentality as they step into either new leadership roles they might not have had, or start to learn and think about how they listen and understand in their environment. Because I think it has impacts on your own relationships, but also on the business. And then even if we think very firmly in the business realm, employee retention and all the staffing stuff that we all think about and talk about, but don't necessarily have the right words to describe how we're trying to bring those things back together. So I love that answer. That's great. So the final one today, is there anything you're working on or are involved in right now that you love the opportunity to plug or share a little bit about today?
I think the thing I'm personally working on, and Swinnerton is working on as a whole as well, is the culture of coaching. And it makes a really big difference in an organization and how people are satisfied with their work. And being taking the time to be a coach to the next generation of leaders, or you can even be a coach to the person sitting next to you for something that they want to learn and you already know. I think it's making a big difference in the retention at Swinnerton. It's making a big difference in the quality of work life for the employees in my departments. And yeah, I think that's, if I was to plug that one thing, it would be that. Be a good coach.
Yeah. It's a big culture thing, and it all comes, all of this interconnects. And so I'm happy to hear that. And I think, as we think about all the new technologies we have on site and processes and such, if you don't have that set up where you have mentors and you have those relationships, it's difficult to deploy some of these things. So again, it's all interconnected. So that's really encouraging to hear. But aside from that, thank you so much for joining me today. And everybody out there listening, thanks for taking the time to listen to another episode of Autodesk Digital Builder Podcast. If you've got any questions or you want to suggest a future guest for an episode, you can reach out to me on LinkedIn, or you can find me via builder_digital out on Twitter. And if you're enjoying the show, you can also watch us on YouTube. All these are video podcasts now. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the different places. And if you could rate our show, I'd appreciate it if you took a moment to do that. Give us 5 stars or whatever you feel appropriate. It helps us out on the back end. But on that final note, goodbye.